Registration is now open for YWCA Madison's 2023 Racial Justice Summit, taking place Tuesday, October 3rd through Thursday, October 5th. This event celebrates humanity, community, and growth, and invites attendees to create new possibilities for intersectional racial justice, collective healing, and liberation. The event is in collaboration with national authors and many other local racial justice practitioners and educators. The summit will offer both in-person and virtual keynote presentations, small group sessions, art, music, community building, and more. Registration is open through September 4th and will offer options to attend virtually and/or in person. To learn more and to register, visit ywcamadison.org/racial-justice-summit. Keeping you informed of community events, this is WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org.
Welcome to Worldview, your weekly source for news and analysis from around the world, right here on community-supported radio, WORT 89.9 FM.
Good evening, and welcome to the Sunday, August 27th edition of Worldview. I'm Lee Rowe, and I'm your host. Later in the program, Gil Halstead will be talking with Cassandra Dixon, who was wounded when she was attacked by an Israeli settler when she was a guest in a Palestinian village. Next week, Cassandra will travel to the occupied Palestine and Israel for the trial of her attacker and for other activities that she'll tell us about. But first, we have the news.
Gabon held presidential, legislative, and local polls simultaneously for the first time yesterday amidst fears that last-minute electoral system changes could confuse voters. President Ali Bongo, who succeeded his father Omar in 2009, is seeking a third term against 18 challengers. In a surprise move, six of them backed a joint nominee in an effort to narrow the race. He is Ondo Ossa, an economics and management professor who has campaigned on the need for change and better economic opportunities. This could resonate in a country where one in three young people are unemployed and a third live in dire poverty. Voting started late at some polling stations. Then, citing the threat of online disinformation, the Gabonese government cut the internet until further notice and imposed a nighttime curfew from today. There is no fixed deadline for the announcement of results, and with the internet shutdown, there has been no news from Gabon in the last 20 hours.
The new military rulers in Niger ordered the armed forces to go on maximum alert yesterday, citing an increased threat of attack. The main West African bloc, the Economic Community of West Africa States, or ECOWAS, has been trying to negotiate with the leaders of the July 26th coup, but has said it is ready to deploy troops to restore constitutional order only if diplomatic efforts fail. On Friday, Niger's foreign ministry announced that the French ambassador had 48 hours to leave, saying that he refused to meet with the new rulers and citing French government actions that were contrary to the interests of Niger. France rejected the demand, saying that the, quote, "Putschists do not have the authority to make this request," unquote, and insisting that the ambassador's approval comes solely from the legitimate elected Nigerian authorities. Similarly, it has not recognized a decision by the junta to revoke military agreements with France, saying that these had been signed with Niger's legitimate authorities. A BBC reporter in the capital said, quote, "The joy and laughter I used to see and hear on the streets has disappeared. Everyone talks about the coup, but only one side is allowed to lead the debate. Anyone who openly opposes the coup risks being beaten up or having their house ransacked," unquote.
Police in India investigated a video that showed a Hindi school teacher telling her pupils to slap their 7-year-old Muslim classmate last Thursday. The boy was in tears as he was slapped, allegedly for getting his timetables wrong. The incident occurred at a private school in Uttar Pradesh in India's north. The video went viral on social media and has triggered widespread dismay and condemnation. The victim's father reported the incident to police in his district and pulled his son out of the school, but did not press charges. The father said that the ill treatment of his son was the result of, quote, hate that is being spread against Muslims in the country, end quote. Authorities confirmed the video was real and said they would take action. India's opposition leader, Rahul Gandhi, blamed the government for stroking religious intolerance, saying, quote, this is the same kerosene spread by the BJP that has set every corner of India on fire, end quote.
The Indian Space Agency announced on Wednesday that it had completed a soft landing on the lunar surface near its southern pole, becoming the first ever to land there and the fourth country to successfully send a mission to the moon at all. The moon lander Vikram was sent to the moon on Chandrayaan-3 at a cost of about $75 million, according to Reuters, less than the cost of most blockbuster space films. India has cultivated a reputation for cost-effective but still successful missions to space, as the country encourages investment in the private space industry and businesses focused on satellites. The price of the entire Indian mission is similar to that charged by SpaceX for one Falcon 9 launch, which was charged at $67 million. The rover carried by the moon lander Vikram is called Pragyan, which is Sanskrit for wisdom. It exited the lander by sliding down a ramp and taking first steps on the lunar surface. It's now roaming around the rocks and craters, gathering crucial data and images to be sent back to Earth for analysis.
Ecuadorians voted this week to keep the country's oil in the subsoil of the Yasuni National Park, one of the most diverse ecosystems in the world, which is situated in the Amazon rainforest. The referendum was one of the issues on the ballot during last Sunday's presidential election, with 59% of voters being in favor of banning oil drilling. Ecuadorian authorities are against this historic referendum and did everything in their power to prevent it. But with global temperatures heating up, activist groups worked harder to stop the drilling. Energy Minister Fernando Santos told Al Jazeera this month that ending the drilling would result, quote, in loss of $1.2 billion annually, which would be detrimental to the country's economy, end quote. Global fossil fuel industries hope that this is an isolated case, as Ecuador's constitution is unique in recognizing rights of nature and promises to protect sensitive ecosystems from harmful activities. But the result was a victory for environmental and indigenous protection.
The Panama Canal will extend transit restrictions for at least 10 more months due to drought-induced low water levels. Restrictions were first announced this year by canal authorities, which caused a backlog of vessels waiting to cross. According to official data, the backlog sits at 115 vessels. The lack of rainwater makes moving through the passage difficult, so officials hope that restrictions will help them hold out until the next rainy season. But they are seeing a peak in arrivals with December approaching and Christmas merchandise moving in quickly. U.S. manufacturers, retailers, and consumers have so far only seen minimal effect, but the potential for disruption is growing. The Panama Canal is an important passageway for shipping that allows ships to travel from the Pacific to the Atlantic Ocean with relative ease. The passageway typically serves vessels from Japan, China, and the U.S. Waiting times to enter are usually 3 to 5 days, but are now up to 11 days on average.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdollahian arrived Thursday in Riyadh, his first official Saudi trip since a landmark rapprochement in March, state media reported. A Chinese broker deal saw the longtime rivals agreeing to restore diplomatic relations and reopen their respective embassies. Shiite-dominated Iran and Sunni-Muslim Saudi Arabia had severed ties in 2016 after Saudi diplomatic missions in the Islamic Republic were attacked during protests over Riyadh's execution of Shiite cleric. In June, Prince Faisal bin Farhan became the first Saudi foreign minister to travel in Iran since 2006. Earlier that month, Iran had reopened its embassy in Riyadh with a flag-raising ceremony. Iran has intensified its diplomatic activity in recent months and pushed for closer ties with other Arab countries in a bid to reduce its isolation and improve its economy. Since the March deal, Saudi Arabia has restored ties with Iranian ally Syria and ramped up a push for peace in Yemen, where it has for years led a military coalition against the Iran-backed Houthi forces.
Despite Iraq's history of being the land that likely first discovered alcohol, it has banned it. Iraqis were officially notified in March that the parliament had banned alcohol and anyone in possession of it could be fined between $8,000 and $19,000. The size of the fines was meant to send a strong message, as it's more than any Iraqi or anyone else could pay. The average monthly income for Iraqis ranges from $150 to $400. And the ban and fines apply not only to the majority Shiite and Sunni Muslim population, but to non-Muslims, including Christians and Yazidis, who up till now have owned most of the liquor stores and rely on the income to feed their families. Many Iraqis have expressed opposition to the new law. No one quite knows where it comes from, and there was no great demand for it from anyone. But looking next door to Iran offers a hint. For years, militias that control the borders have profited from bribes paid by smugglers of alcohol to Iran. Because alcohol in Iraq is now banned, the militias could step up the drug trade from Iran, offering Iraqis an expensive alternative to alcohol. Something similar has been the case in officially Islamic Iran, where the Islamic Revolutionary Guards profit handsomely from smuggling operations, including alcohol. And those are our headlines for today. And now here's Maria with our first longer story.
Nearly a million Rohingya fled their native Myanmar on August 25, 2017, after its military launched what the UN described as a campaign with, quote, genocidal intent, end quote, against the mostly Muslim minority. As the Myanmar military began to kill Rohingya men, rape women, and burn their villages that day, more than 750,000 of them fled to neighboring Bangladesh, where they were sheltered in the southern Cox Bazar district, now the world's largest refugee camp. Since then, the refugees observe August 25th as Genocide Day to demand justice and seek safe and voluntary reparation to their homes in Myanmar. But although they escaped violence and death in Myanmar, Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh lead a precarious existence, losing hope of safely returning to their now military-ruled homeland and being shunned by the rest of the world. Journalist Camille Ahmed interviewed hundreds of such refugees for his book, I Feel No Peace, and found that they have almost lost hope of returning safely to Myanmar. Ahmed told Al Jazeera, quote, they also believe they can't live dignified lives in the refugee camps. These refugees are utterly stateless and marginalized wherever they are, end quote. In December 2021, Bangladesh shut down all the refugee-run schools in which Rohingya children were being taught the Myanmar curriculum. The students now pass their days doing nothing. The Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh camps rely almost entirely on food aid, as they are not allowed to leave the camps or formally work. Since March, the World Food Program assisted to a million refugees was cut by a third to just $8 per month due to a funding shortfall. Save the Children said in a statement on Thursday, quote, even before the first food ration cuts, 45% of Rohingya families were not eating a sufficient diet, and malnutrition was widespread in the camps, with 40% of children experiencing stunted growth, end quote. The humanitarian response, it's at a breaking point, it said, adding that the children are in danger of becoming a lost generation. Dr. Delwar Hussain, director of East Asia Study Center at Dhaka University, told Al Jazeera the world's attention has already moved from the Rohingya refugees, and they possibly have become a, quote, permanent fixture with the Bangladeshi territory, end quote.
The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, or ZEC, declared incumbent President Emmerson Mnangagwa the winner of Zimbabwe's August 23rd presidential election at 11:30 last night. The ZEC said Mnangagwa from the ruling ZANU-PF party polled 52% of the vote, ahead of 44% for Nelson Chamisa, who leads the opposition Citizens Coalition for Change, or CCC. The CCC said its own tally of the results showed Chamisa leading, and it will contest the outcome. Chamisa wrote in a post on X, formerly known as Twitter, in his first public reaction to the results, quote, they stole your voice and vote, but never your hope. It's a blatant and gigantic fraud, unquote. Regional and international observer missions criticized the electoral process last week, citing delays in delivering polling material, voting delays, banning rallies, and biased state media coverage. The Southern Africa Development Community, or SADC, said some election aspects, quote, fell short of Zimbabwe's constitution and electoral rules. The African Union expressed concerns about voters being turned away at 30% of stations it visited, and the arrest and detention of civil society observers. The head of the African Union observer mission, former Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan, said the activities of Mugabe-backed Forever Associates of Zimbabwe, or FAZ, should be declared criminal offenses. U.S. Embassy observers and the EU observer mission said that they were concerned about problems with the transparency, independence, fairness, and credibility of the electoral processes. Other international groups raised concerns over alleged voter intimidation by FAZ. Although Mnangagwa's ruling ZANU-PF won 136 of the parliamentary seats ahead of the CCC's 73, it fell short of the key two-thirds majority of 140 constituencies it would need to push through Mnangagwa policies and legislation, such as a constitutional amendment to extend his tenure beyond the two-year limit. Zimbabwe has a history of both pre- and post-election violence, leaving little doubt that government authorities will use force to quell protests, particularly from the opposition. Reuters quoted a security guard at a grocery store who, when he heard the election results, said, quote, it's done. It never changes. I had some hope. Now it's better to prepare to join the others who have left the country. That's the best option, unquote. With Mnangagwa's victory now confirmed, many fear that after decades of mismanagement, the prospects for the country's economy have become even bleaker.
Last October, Haiti's de facto government leader, Ariel Henry, officially requested that the UN supply international military assistance to fight the armed criminal gangs that blocked access to fuel, extorted funds by kidnapping and threats, killed with impunity, and battled each other for territory and influence. Several countries backed the idea of sending a multilateral force to Haiti, but no country volunteered to head the force. Both the U.S. and the U.N. have had disastrous periods of peacekeeping and peacemaking in Haiti, and neither wanted to try again. There was also pushback from Haitians who had suffered under U.S. and U.N. missions and insisted they have a say in resolving the crisis. The U.S. leader leaned on Canada to lead, but it said it would not be able to provide leadership and a force for such a mission. Finally, and surprisingly, last month, Kenya announced its willingness to lead a potential mission with 1,000 soldiers, which was welcomed by both the U.S. government and the U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres. U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said the U.S. would introduce a Security Council resolution to authorize the deployment. Canada, Jamaica, and the Bahamas announced they would support the effort. Kenyans said they first wanted to visit Haiti, but Haitian civil society organizations and social movements strongly opposed the idea of allowing foreign troops in the country and condemned the international community for supporting Henri, who, along with his ruling far-right Haitian Tête Calé Party, or PHTK, they hold responsible for the economic, social, political, and institutional crises facing the country. Jean Jossant, a professor at Syracuse University, questioned the choice of Kenya to lead such a mission, given the language barrier. He said, quote, "I don't think 1,000 soldiers can solve the problem in Haiti, especially coming from Kenya, because they don't speak French, don't speak Haitian Creole, and cannot communicate directly to the population," end quote. There are also concerns about the Kenyan forces' reputation. The Associated Press reported that, quote, "As the U.S. government was considering Kenya to lead a multinational force in Haiti, it was also openly warning Kenyan police officers against violent abuses," end quote. Haitian ex-Prime Minister Claude Joseph also expressed concern, saying, quote, "Kenya is embroiled in its own internal socio-political crisis. The anti-government protests against the rising cost of living are violently repressed by the police. Can a police force that is not professional in its own country act as such abroad?" End quote.
A 10-member Kenyan assessment mission arrived in Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, on August 20th. To evaluate the security situation. It met with senior government officials, the police, and the diplomatic corps of other nations during its 3-day visit and left on August 23rd. The visit and the plan was condemned by Haitian progressive organizations and rights groups, which strongly opposed foreign intervention. Haiti's Ministry of Communication reported in a statement on August 23rd that the high command of the National Police Kenyan delegation found the visit very useful. "All parties have the same understanding of the mission, not to replace the National Police or to carry out its work, but coming to help it become more efficient, more adapted, better capable of fulfilling its mission to protect and serve." It seems the understanding was that the Kenyans would protect infrastructure while the police would pursue gangs. A former peacekeeper who had battled gangs in Haiti told the Miami Herald that any foreign intervention must include a plan to neutralize the gangs as well as to tackle organized crime, help the police, and put pressure on the Haitian government. "It also needs to address government corruption and investment in communities using Haitian government revenues. Otherwise, it will not succeed." He said, quote, "Frankly speaking, they are playing a game here with the suffering of the people," unquote. Paul D. Williams, who studies peace operations, emerging security threats, and warfare, mainly in Africa, and teaches at George Washington University, said that he believes the chances of success for any anti-gang operation in Haiti are very low. He said that combating organized criminal gangs is a notoriously difficult task for foreign peacekeepers, especially in a complex urban environment. He said, quote, there are no good options for outsiders to eradicate these gangs, unquote. Williams also asked, quote, will Kenya stay in Haiti when the going gets tough? Kenya previously withdrew its contingent from the UN mission in South Sudan in 2016 after the UN sacked its force commander in that mission, unquote. Another worrisome sign was that the Kenyans were so fearful of the volatility and the gangs that they stayed at their U.S. embassy housing and chose to hold their meetings at a hotel across from the airport, just in case they needed to leave quickly.
According to a new Human Rights Watch report released on Monday, between March 2022 and June 2023, Saudi border guards killed hundreds of Ethiopian migrants attempting to cross the border from Yemen into the Saudi kingdom. The report comes as Saudi Arabia implements an anti-migrant policy at home and a campaign to boost its image abroad. The rocky mountainous region around Sadaa, a city in northern Yemen near the Saudi border, has turned into lethal terrain, according to human rights groups. Bodies of dead or seriously wounded migrants, mostly from Ethiopia, have been spotted in satellite imagery and social media posts from the border, providing a harrowing testimony of abuses. A Human Rights Watch released last Monday, appropriately titled, They Fired on Us Like Rain, records widespread abuses committed on the Yemen-Saudi border between March 2022 and June 2023. A July 5th report by the Mixed Migrant Center, an independent data institution within the Danish Refugee Council, said Ethiopians were being systematically killed by, quote, security officials operating under Saudi Arabian state authority, end quote. The latest human rights report provides witness accounts of Ethiopian migrants who tried to cross the border from Yemen to Saudi Arabia, and it makes grim reading. It consists of numerous eyewitness accounts. While the exact number of migrants killed while crossing the border is impossible to determine, the Human Rights Watch report was compiled from interviews with 42 Ethiopians or relatives of Ethiopians who attempted the border crossing. The rights group also analyzed more than 350 videos and photographs posted on social media or gathered from other sources, in addition to satellite imagery. The report notes, quote, while Human Rights Watch has previously documented killings of migrants at the border with Yemen and Saudi Arabia since 2014, the killings documented in this report appear to be a deliberate escalation in both the number and manner of targeted killings, end quote.
And that's a wrap of news from around the world for Sunday, August 27th, 2023. Sources we used to prepare today's stories were Africa News, Agence France-Presse, Alborada, All Africa, Amnesty International, the BBC, Deutsche Welle, France 24, The Guardian, Human Rights Watch, Independent, The Miami Herald, NPR, People's Dispatch, Reuters, and Semaphore.
فلسطين تاج عالراس في العين وفي قلوب الناس عشق المجروح وجوا الروح مع الله وانا مهما رحت ولفيت زي حضنك والله ما لقيت كل واحد شافك سمى وقال ما شاء الله
فلسطين تاج عالراس في العين وفي قلوب الناس
عشق المجروح وجوا الروح مع الله وانا مهما رحت ولفيت زي حضنك والله ما لقيت
كل واحد شافك سمى وقال
ما شاء الله
يلا
كل مكان فخور فيكي. حيوا الوطن حيوا اسم الوطن علو في أرضك رجال تهز جبال وتفديكي. وين ما نروح معاك نروح ونشهد علينا الله
تاج عالراس
عشق المجروح وجوه الروح حماها الله. وانا مهما رحت ولفيت زي حضنك والله ما لقيت
كل واحد شافك سمى وقال ما شاء الله.
Welcome to the August 27th edition of the Worldview Feature. I'm Gil Halstead. I'm your host, and we're joined tonight by Cassandra Dixon, who is on her way back to Palestine in about a week to take part in a trial of the Israeli settler who attacked her back on March 7th of this year. And she's here preparing for that. We want to talk about what led up to the attack on her and the context in which it took place. So my headphones are not working properly, but so Cassandra, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, sorry about the technical difficulty there, but it's important for me to hear myself. It reassures me. So, Cassandra, we've talked to you before soon after this happened, when you came back after the attack there. But I think it's important to, and I think what I'd like to do actually is just to read one of the recent things that you've written about this that describe the area where this attack happened, and you can, and we can talk a little bit about why you were there on a regular basis each year. So I want to read this because I think that it will really help give us the context. So imagine being one of 569 children living under military occupation in the area of Palestine claimed by Israel as firing zone 918. Soldiers conduct war games around you, tanks crush your family's crops, and helicopters terrorize your sheep and goats. Your home and school, your water well, your barns and animal pens can be demolished at any time. This is life in Musafir Yatta, a group of villages in the South Hebron Hills of the West Bank where 1,150 Palestinians live and 215 households. This nightmare began back in the 1980s. When Israeli settlers began seizing land for illegal settlements. Israeli authorities obligingly declared part of Musafir Yatta firing zone 918, one of many that occupied 20% of the West Bank. It had nothing to do with security, and everything to do with grabbing land. Began back with Ariel Sharon, who explained at a 1979 meeting of the World Zionist Organization, as the person who initiated the military fire zones in 1967, they were all intended for one purpose, to provide an opportunity for Jewish settlement in the area. I'm going to skip down a little bit here. So Israel gets approximately $8 million in our taxes daily from the United States. Each of us is therefore responsible for the use of that military aid against the civilian population. We must move our elected representatives to do more and condition appropriations to Israel on their human rights record. You experienced, Cassandra, the human rights violation while you were there. So I'm just give you a couple of minutes here to describe briefly what happened on March 7th.
Okay. And thank you so much to WRT for covering these things, because otherwise we would not know. So thank you for that. So I was visiting the village of Tuba, which is inside of the area Israel claims as a firing zone and located in Musafer Yatta. I was there because settlers in that area have been more and more aggressively, and this has escalated also since I left there, seizing more and more land. So they have been doing that through a combination of occupying the land with settler flocks of sheep and goats, and by launching violent attacks against people who live on that land, either while they're out with their flocks, and also coming actually inside the villages and attacking people in their homes and inside the villages. So that's why I was there. And that particular morning, there were settlers out using a flock to destroy a crop. So it's basically a way of stealing that farming family's crop, and in this case, fodder for those animals for the year. So that crop had been planted during the winter. The land had been cultivated, and that crop grew and was just like ready for those sheep to eat it. And settlers brought in a flock and were day by day destroying more and more of that cultivated crop. So that's what we were seeing happen that morning. And there were settlers there, but at some point we turned to go back into the village, and that's when we were chased. And so the person I was with was chased by a settler who was waving an iron bar at him. And while I was watching that, another settler hit me on the back of the head. So,
right. So let me clarify. I guess maybe I didn't understand this clearly. So that the settlers have their own flock?
Yes.
And I guess it's okay for them to graze their flock on this, what is supposed to be a firing range?
Well, they're grazing their flocks on privately owned Palestinian land. And right, if there is some logic in the idea that these Palestinian villages are being evicted because they have decided that they want to use this firing zone for live ammunition, but that doesn't apply to the settlers. And in fact, so these particular settlers are from an illegal outpost. Well, all of the settlements are illegal under international law. The outposts are also illegal under Israeli law until they're not. So there are now 9 illegal outposts that are in the process of being legalized by Israel. And 2 of those are in that area, and that legalization will also give them permission to greatly expand. So those are in that firing zone. Like if there was some theory that it's dangerous to be there, well, apparently there is a workaround, because it is like they're still allowed to steal that land. So if Palestinians can't absolutely prove use of their agricultural land for a 3-year period, that land can be seized as state land and then can be basically given to settlers to use. And that is also happening there. So through organized way of making people afraid to use their land through attacking people often enough and causing problems often enough, they can prevent, if they are successful in preventing people from getting out there and also being able to document the fact that they were cultivating that land and they were using those crops to feed their own flocks, then the theft of that land becomes legalized.
With these kind of distinctions, the kind of legal and illegal distinctions you're describing, Cassandra, likely to play any kind of role in this judicial process that you're going to be going back to communicate to take part in, or probably not? You don't know until you get there. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. But I would say that the fact that I was attacked and the fact that people who live there, I mean, just this last week, settlers came all the way into the village of Tuba and terrorized people inside their homes. They sprayed pepper gas directly into the eyes of old people. And a couple weeks before that, they had come and broken into homes with soldiers present backing them up, smashed up furniture, terrified children, destroyed personal belongings inside of houses, and basically just rampaged through the village. So this is like a, you know, constant. If it doesn't happen today, it might happen tomorrow. If it doesn't happen this week, it might happen next week. It's like everyone is going to sleep every single night with the knowledge that that could happen. And sometimes there are settlers out at night. You can see lights moving around. And okay, maybe that's the day that they come and beat up your mother, and maybe it's not. But people are living with that fear all the time.
And the expectation then is that the villagers will leave. I mean, that's what the settlers' expectation is, and Israeli government apparently is that they will just go away, and the settlers will, this illegal settlement will become just a reality.
That illegal outpost will itself be legalized, and that new outposts will be built. It's a land grab.
Right. And there's no... So the rule of law is one of the things I wanted to address in some way, but I guess you're going to experience what that is when you go back. You've not been involved in a legal dispute in a courtroom about this kind of situation in the past. But I mean, it sounds like settlers are not held accountable for actual violent attacks on Palestinians. As long as it's on Palestinians, it's okay.
It's extremely rare for a settler to be brought to court. And Palestinians, like in these recent attacks, people have gone and filed complaints. Palestinians have gone. In order to file a complaint, you have to go inside another settlement to an Israeli police station. So Palestinians don't have any access to a legal system of their own representation. So this settler who attacked me is able to attend court proceedings in his own language, in his own country, and it's a civil court. Palestinians who are charged are forced into a military court system, so they would attend those court proceedings in a military courtroom, and they're dealing with a military court system that is not from their own country. So it's as if, you know, somebody from Canada, right? Like if my child was caught up in something and was charged with throwing a stone or getting too close to a police car or whatever, would have to be taken to Canada and tried in a military court in Canada, right? This is insane, right? But this is the way it is. And Palestinians filing complaints might go to that police station in that settlement and wait for hours and hours and hours in rain or under the hot sun. Someone will just refuse to hear that complaint or say, well, we're busy, you'll have to come back the next day, and over and over and over again. So even creating any legal record of the fact that they're filing complaints can be very difficult.
But in your case, because of your status as an American citizen and a, I guess, a a legal visitor to Italy, I mean, to Israel while you were there, the case takes on a different nature than the ones you've just described for Palestinians, right?
Right. Well, I'm the victim in this.
I understand. Right.
So.
Right, but Palestinians were victims as well. I mean, you're a different kind of victim, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, it is thanks to my U.S. citizenship and my whiteness and the fact that friends were able to put pressure on elected officials here and Tammy Baldwin's office and Mark Pocan's office, put pressure on the State Department, which then turned around and let the police department there know that they were tracking the case. I mean, so without all of that, I'm sure that the settler would not have been charged.
Right. Okay.
I know that for a fact, because in all of the attacks that have happened since then, no settler has been charged.
And they weren't attacks on American white women, right?
Right. Right. Exactly.
So we're talking with Cassandra Dixon, who is heading back to Israel next week to take part in a trial about an attack that occurred while she was there in March, carried out by an Israeli settler while she was, you were just standing there, basically watching what was going on that you've described earlier in the conversation. But I want to give you, Cassandra, a chance to talk about more recent events that have been going on there, okay? Because there is another trial coming up of someone we've actually interviewed on this show, Sami Hourani.
Sami Hourani.
Sami Hourani. It was a result of a similar kind of confrontation between settlers and Palestinians in which you were involved in, right?
Right. So my friend Sammy lives in the village of Tuani, which is very close to Touba. It's the village that the school children from Touba walk to go to school, so it's close. And early in 2002, early in January of 2002, Israeli soldiers shot and paralyzed a man who was trying to prevent them from stealing his village's generator in the village of Rakiz, which is just a little bit south of Tuani. And he has since died of those wounds. But in the days following that shooting, and he was shot in the neck from behind, he was not threatening anyone. He had both hands on the generator, and there was no threat to the soldiers who shot him. So there were demonstrations in protest of that, and Sammy was arrested during one of those demonstrations for exercising his right to free speech. And over the course of the intervening years, he's been back to court many times and finally was found guilty some days ago. So is facing sentencing now at the end of October. So there is if people would like to sign a petition, you can go to tiny.one/freesammy. And I bet WORT will post this link.
Sure.
So on change.org. So the community there, though, has called on the international community to speak out, because it's this is a targeting of someone who is from a family who has been resisting the occupation there for a long, long time. During the intervening years since he was initially charged, his father, who was at the time cultivating his own land, was attacked and then was charged with attempted murder of a settler, even though settlers actually during that event beat him with iron bars and broke both of his arms. He was, during that arrest, yanked out of the ambulance by the soldiers and hauled off in the back of a Jeep instead of an ambulance, and has he'll never be right again. His arms and hands will never be what they should be again. And more recently, Sammy's brother was arrested also for no particular reason and interrogated and released. He had been out with his father also on their own land. And then some days later, he was kidnapped by soldiers on his way home from doing some errands for his family, and held and interrogated and blindfolded, left on the floor, harassed by soldiers, and eventually dumped out near a settlement, and where he was very unsafe. I mean, the stuff that the impunity with which soldiers can act in these situations is horrendous, and would give us pause if it happened here, for sure. So this is a family that's being targeted for the fact that they have remained in Tuani during all of this time, mm-hmm. have refused to leave, and have been very, very instrumental in helping to increase the presence of internationals in that area, and extremely committed to nonviolent response. So if there is something to be learned from that, I think that both the settlers and the soldiers there have tried very hard to provoke this family into a violent response and have not succeeded. And so instead have chosen to charge one family member after another with non-existent crimes. In Sammy's case, there's video evidence of the entire demonstration, and that shows him doing absolutely nothing. And there are multiple witnesses, including Israeli peace activists who are there, who were watching him doing exactly nothing. And yet that Israeli military court found him guilty anyway. So I wanted to mention one other thing, though, that's happening in response to these things.
Yes, I was going to actually direct you there, if I could. I think it's that what people here can do.
Could do, right. And yes. So I really encourage you to sign that petition, and also to get hold of your elected officials and let them know that they should step in and prevent the sentencing of that person from having done nothing. Also in that area, countless olive trees have been destroyed by settlers, uprooted, burned, slashed, cut down by both settlers and also by the military using bulldozers. In the time that I've been going there, which is like 12 or 14 years, I've seen entire groves demolished by backhoes and bulldozers during the day.
Right, and the reason, I mean, the justification for actually destroying the olive trees is that this is a firing zone. I mean, why uproot olive trees? I mean, what's the government justification? Is this because they belong to Palestinians, or is there any?
I don't know.
Okay.
If there's a justification, I don't know it.
Okay.
But it is the fact that since 2001, Israel has destroyed over 1 million Palestinian olive trees. But you could plant an olive tree. So there is a Dutch organization that has been supplying olive trees to families who have lost them there. And the planting of those trees also creates documentation of the use of the land for agricultural purposes, so can help people who have court proceedings going on to try to hang on to their land. Madison has entered into a plan to plant an entire grove of olives. So it's called the Madison Masafriata Olive Grove. And if you would like to sponsor a tree, the cost is about $22. It's 20 euros. And you can go to tiny.one/Madison Olive Grove and sponsor a tree. So this is if any of you have ever contemplated giving a gift through the Heifer Project, where you, instead of actually giving some object that your friends don't actually need, you could give the gift of having given someone else something that they really need. So these olive trees are a fantastic gift, and I highly recommend this.
And this is a relatively new effort. I mean, have there been similar efforts that you know about this?
This organization planted trees there. So the trees are planted in the spring planting season, which is kind of December through March. And they planted quite a lot of trees this past year, and will be doing this again.
Are they planted in an area that we can be any way assured that the bulldozers aren't going to move in and get rid of them?
In the dozen years I've been going there, I have seen people replant trees a dozen times in the same place.
So. Right.
There's still a tree there. So.
It's been uprooted and replanted.
Many, many, many times.
Really? Yeah. Okay. Well, I want to return. We have got about 5 minutes left in the interview, Cassandra, to what your senses of what you're going to be facing when you go back on September 6th for this judicial process. And we talked a little about before, and you're really not sure how it could, how it might play out or what the rules and regulations are going to be about the role you're going to be able to play as a victim trying to hold accountable an attacker.
So I think the thing that is most difficult and distressing for me, and which I think like I can't not see in doing this, is my own culpability in what's happening there. So I am a U.S. citizen. My country hugely supports the state of Israel. Well, $8 million a day, $3.8 billion a year. It's an enormous amount of money. The great majority of it is in military aid. A lot of it circles back to us because it's used for weaponry that's purchased from us, tear gas canisters that are purchased from us, or whatever the object is. But I think that, so I have been traveling there for a lot of years, and I've become, the same place. So I know people there, and I've watched them grow up, and I've watched these kids who had to run this gauntlet to get to school are now young adults who are helping kids to survive this still. And they're very dear to me. And so I think that what I feel for this place now actually qualifies as solidarity in a way that it didn't for the first year or the first 5 years or the first 6 or 8 years that I did this. It was maybe a longing for solidarity, but I think that this has kind of pushed me a little farther for this. But I find actually that there is, I have not yet found a way to live into that. So in every interaction I have with these people who are so precious to me, the inequity between our lives is unconscionable.
So we hope that there is an outcome of this, of your return visit right now, that will have an impact on exactly what you're talking about right now, that will have some way to... I guess from my perspective, to actually hold someone accountable for what happened.
It's probably a small chance, right?
Yes. I mean, I think, even the fact that it's gone this far, and
right.
I hope that there's been, a conversation with Tammy Baldwin and a conversation with Mark Pocan. And I know friends of mine from other parts of the country have engaged with their elected people. And I hope even amongst us on the progressive left, whatever we call ourselves, like we have to address this. This is the $8 million a day elephant in the room. And we don't get to be progressive without looking this in the face. So I hope that maybe that's pushed us that way a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And I came in now just to make sure, is this the address tiny.one?
Yes, it's like, when you shorten a URL.
Uh-huh.
So, right, it's the...
Tiny dot the number one?
Tiny dot O-N-E.
And
then backslash. Madison Olive Grove.
Madison
Olive
Grove.
Or Free Sammy.
Okay. So, tiny dot O-N-E / Madison Olive Grove?
Yes.
Okay.
And the petition for Sammy is tiny.one/freesammy, S-A-M-I.
Okay. So I have to thank you for coming, Cassandra. Thank you for being here too, Gil. And thank you for listening. And please join us next week for a new edition of Worldview here on your community-sponsored radio, WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.